And let's give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Tom from the Prince George Study Home Group.
Thank you.
Good evening, Quinn. You hear that all right? Okay. Let's see. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm Tom Gibson. I have been a continuously sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 14,365 one days at a time as of today. If you don't want to do the math, that's a little over 39 years. I am a member of the Liberty Bell Group in Hopewell, Virginia. And I've been asked by our friends from the Prince George Study Group to come in and do this. So just remember you asked for this. Okay, I think I am what you call a real alcoholic. I was born to alcoholic parents into an alcoholic household. I grew up around people who drank to excess, who drank for every conceivable reason and occasion. You know, if you got up in our house on a Saturday morning, you know, after just a Friday night, or especially if there was any kind of festivities, a birthday or a christening or a funeral or anything, the floor would be, the way I remember it, littered with bodies. You know, there were just people who, even if they only lived up the block, didn't think they could or didn't think it wise to try to get on home, or else didn't see the point, you know. And so breakfast then would ensue, and the day would start with Bloody Marys and red beer and all kinds of stuff. And so anyway, that's how I grew up. I started drinking at a very early age. I had my first blackout that I can remember when I was 19. I was in the service. I was home on a weekend leave, and I had gone to a party with some friends, and I drank everything in sight. Well, the guy that I rode to the party with when he was leaving found me outside on the lawn and rolled me into the back seat of his car. And on the way home, he stopped in a gas station and he saw across the street, this was about midnight, and he saw across the street his mother getting off a bus. And we were in her car and he was supposed to have gone and picked her up. So he just dragged me out and left me there by the service station island, completely unconscious, and drove over and, you know, picked up his mom, and I'm sure started apologizing immediately, but I was there. And the next person into there kindly didn't run over me, but went and got the attendant and said, "I think there's a dead man out here." And so they, I woke up in jail. I woke up in the drunk tank of the 15th Precinct in Philadelphia, and it wasn't pleasant, and I didn't know where I was or why I was there. And I went before the magistrate, and he said, you know why you're here? And I said, I guess I was drunk, I don't know. He said, "That's right, and you were found laying on the street, and so that's like vagrancy or something." I can't even remember what he called it, but I said, "Well, I'm sorry, you know, and what can I do?" And he said, "Well, you don't have to do anything. We've already called the MPs, and they're on their way." So I was about 9 months into the United States Air Force when I got my first Article 15 of many, and, you know, and it carried on from there. But everywhere I went, you know, I caused trouble for myself. You know, when I went to to boot camp. I had an opportunity, because apparently I test well. I was given an opportunity to attend officers' training school. And, but they told me that you could not be married in the Air Force Academy. And I had a girlfriend. So I was obviously not going to go be an officer, because I was going to get married and have a bunch of kids. Well, about 3 weeks later, I get a letter, you know, addressed to some guy named John.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, yeah. And she had, you know, found a new love. And so I dashed to the first sergeant's office and said, hey, you know, man, I'd really like to take advantage of this opportunity. And he said, no, that ship has sailed. That window's closed. You missed your opportunity for that. Well, I was brokenhearted and I was pissed off. So, you know, where to but the bar? You know, I went out the back gate of the base, went into a bar, and woke up in jail. And then back onto the base for another Article 15. Well, I gathered up enough of those that in the 3 years that I managed to stay in, they came to me and just said, look, you know, we don't want to have to wait until you kill somebody or something and give you a dishonorable discharge. We're going to offer you a bad conduct discharge right now. And I said, thank God, let me out. So then I found out that meant no GI Bill and no VA and all that. But then they told me you can apply to have this changed. You know, get your congressman or representative to write a letter and they'll probably change this for you if you don't, you know, get in any more trouble. Well, you know, I had a letter from the base commander that said, you are not permitted on any military installation anywhere without the express written permission of the base commander. 2 days later, I was driving cab in and out of the gate of that base selling pot on them. In a taxi cab, driving cab. Never blinked. They never even blinked. So anyway, you know, I did that. I got, you know, I drove cab for a while, and then they found out that my license wasn't really any good. So they, you know, they just took that job away, and I had to go find ways to make money. And I had to support my drinking habit. So sitting in a bar one night and with two guys that I had just met, said, you know, we need to get some money. I'm out of beer and we got no cash. I said, well, I don't know what to do. He says, I'm tapped. I said, man, if I was back, this was in Alaska, by the way, I had to go to Alaska in the Air Force. And I said, man, if I was back in Philly, I would just go across the street and rob that gas station. Little bravado there. I'd never robbed a gas station before, but, you know, at the time, it seemed a good idea. So this guy says, you can use my car. And the bartender says, well, I got an old gun under here. He said, go ahead. So one guy drives and I'm in the driver's seat. We just drive into this gas station. I walk in, give me all your money, dirt quad. Okay, sure. So I walked out of there with, I think, $16. You know, I guess it was a slow night for gas in East Anchorage, Alaska. But anyway, so we drove back around to the back of the bar where we had been parked and just went right back in directly across the street, drank up that $16 in about 10 minutes, and then had to go do something else. So we robbed 9 places that week. And we weren't the smartest people in the world, as you might imagine, but I robbed a place that it was a tiny little A&W hamburger stand. And It was dark out, it was late at night, it was winter, it was icy, and the place was deserted except for this young girl working in there, and I went up to the window with my gun, and, you know, and just said, you know, give me all the money, and she just turned around and stepped through a door into what was a little bathroom, I guess, in there for them, but it had a buzzer, and she buzzed the house behind the place where this old man and his son lived that owned the place. And so, since she didn't come out, I thought we should hightail it, and I was slipping and sliding across the parking lot, and this guy comes out his door with a 12-gauge shotgun and fires a shot in the air, and I cleverly let one loose at him. You know, because I'm a badass. Well, I missed him, thank God. But he, you know, and then we jumped in the car and went and got stuck in the snow, and the police came and, you know, searched the car, and in the car was the gun that belonged to nobody, but I was the only person who had used it. And all the people from other places I had robbed had just grabbed stuff out of the cash register and thrown them in this bag. So in there was checks, you know, saying where they were written to, and receipts and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, there wasn't really any getting out of this. So I went to jail. Well, I had a friend whose mother was a psychology professor at the local university, the University of Anchorage, and she, Alaska, and she stood up for me in court, you know, and said, well, this poor kid, you know, and his first offense as a adult, because it was, I had just turned 21, and yada, 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 and so they gave me a break, gave me two-year sentences, ran them concurrently, and that was that. But while I was in there, I get a visit from this trooper, and he says to me, you are a very lucky boy. And this was before I was sentenced, so I was facing 2 30-year sentences. And so I'm thinking, I'm going to be, or 2 15-year sentences, sorry, I'm going to be 50 years old by the next time I see daylight, you know, that doesn't have stripes in it. And I said, what's lucky? He said, that old man that you shot at, he says, is a former state skeet shooting champion and an ex-state trooper, retired state trooper. He said, you're lucky. When he told his son to grab his gun, his son only put one shell in it. That was a long barrel, close held Winchester 1200, and the distance you were from him, he would have put a hole in you about this size, and he could not have missed. You are a very lucky man. Well, I didn't thank my lucky stars, you know, and that was that. I spent 17 months in, and I got out into a halfway house. And the first thing I, even before I got out, the day before I got out, they came to me and said, okay, we're going to give you, let you out on your own recognizance and go to the dentist. Here's the address. This is downtown, from the old territorial prison in downtown Anchorage, and it's just a few blocks to the thing. But I started walking down to this dentist, and I'm passing this bar that I used to hang out in all the time. Well, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, but I thought, well, I'll just go see if anybody I know is around. I went in, the place is deserted, and this girl's behind the bar, and she said, can I help you? I said, I don't know. Well, how's my credit? She said, well, what's your name? I told her my name. She went to the little box behind the bar. And she said, oh. She said, well, you haven't charged anything lately. I guess it's pretty good. So I proceeded to sit there and drink a few beers. I went to the dentist. Dentist says, I can't do anything with you. You're drunk. I said, I'm not drunk. I had a couple of beers. I mean, anybody, I'm going to the dentist. Anybody going to the dentist is going to have a couple of drinks first. That was only logical to me. He said, well, look, you're fine. they owned the paper, gave it back to me. And I thought, well, that didn't take very long at all. I should go back to the bar. I went back to the bar, and I was still sitting at that bar drinking beers when people started coming in. And I said, well, you know, you get a nice lunch crowd. She said, we didn't have anybody in here at lunch. This guy's after work. I'm like, oh shit. I stumbled the three blocks back to the jail and buzzed the gate, and this guy let me in, and I swear he must have been one of us, because he just looked at me and he said, you're drunk. I said, I'm not drunk, I've been to the dentist. You know, he gave me stuff. Come here. Put me in a back room. I fell asleep on some packing crates, and the next morning they came and let me out, and I went to the halfway house. And I did nothing but drink my way out of everything that I got into. So that is kind of how I react to alcohol. You know, and there's a million stories like those too. But I got married, a couple kids, got a really good job up in Point Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost year-round inhabited city or town on the continent, right on the edge of the Bering Sea. It's a dry town, and it was boring. There was no bowling alley, no movie theater. You know, you could rent a film or something, but that was it. And everybody was making a ton of money. It was oil field money, and it was a lot. And so I was making the most money I ever had in my life when somebody said, you know what? This day'd go a lot better if we just did a few lines of this stuff. Okay, well, that goes well with drinking. So I started bringing in booze, you know, for my own use and for my friends. And it got to be quite a lot. It got to be so much that, well, I'll tell you after I get, tell you what happened was that I got strung out to the point where my wife took my two children and left. And I didn't find out how she did that until years later when, you know, an IRS tribunal asked her how she, if I was used, because I had to go before them because I owed a lot of money, and that my reasoning, you know, for doing that, for going tax exempt when I was making $60,000 a year and like that, was that I was a drunk, an alcoholic, and a drug addict, and I wasn't responsible for my own affairs. So, fine. They asked my wife, how did you manage to get the money then to fly from Point Barrow, Alaska to New York? She went to my kids and went home. And she said, his crew took up a collection, Jesus, and gave me the money to leave him. So that's kind of the shape I was in. But she left town, my boss left town, on the same airplane. And on that airplane, I got a couple of ounces in and a couple of cases of vodka. So I thought, party time. You know, this is great. And I just went off. And I went off for a year. You know, and I got arrested. And then, so, and convicted. But then I got out on appeal, and that was another year. So by the time that my appeal fell through, which I knew it was going to, I had spent 2 years, more than 2 years, just solidly trying to imbibe, inject, snort, collect anything I could get my hands on. And when my appeal fell through, they took me to prison, And when I went through the door, I weighed 118 pounds. My blood pressure was through the roof. My teeth were falling out, you know, and I had a heart murmur. And they immediately put me in medical isolation, which is good because I was still getting high right up to the point that they took me out the door. So the I was then, you know, tubes in my arms, tubes down my throat, and going through the whips and jingles of withdrawals, you know, for a week. And they came to me and said, well, Mr. Gibson, the state of Alaska, in its infinite wisdom, has decreed that if you are in here on a drug or alcohol-related beef, which you are, and there's a recovery meeting anywhere in the facility, you have to be allowed to go. Would you like to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? Well, if they'd have said, we're taking a bunch of guys out back and setting fire to them and peeing on them to put it out, would you like to go? I would have jumped at the chance just to get out of that bed. And I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the prison. And a fella came into that meeting. And you know, you'll hear it all the time. Somebody say, and he told my story. You know, I don't know if that guy was in this room tonight and told the exact same story in the exact same words that I would even relate to him. You know, but I did that day because he talked about his life breaking down by the side of the road. And that every time something good was about to happen, like to go for a job interview or to go meet a blind date or to get, you know, to go visit with his family, he would get screwed up. And he would either show up so screwed up as to be, you know, inhuman, or he wouldn't show up at all. I thought, man, I know that guy. You know, I know that guy. And he said, but, he says, I ran into a guy who had this book, this big blue book. And he told me that this was the repair manual for my broken down life. He said, in here is a kit of tools. He says, and what you need is somebody who knows, who has used these tools and has and knows how to make them work to show you how to do it. He said, and I went for it. I said, all right. You know, and I thought, man, if that's true, you know, because he then said, my life changed. You know, I had lost my wife, my kids, my home, my vehicles. I was homeless. I was destitute. I was sick. He said, and today, I have a life second to none. You know, I have two vehicles in my driveway. I have a nice home. I have another wife. I have children. I'm sorry, Coy. You need a nap. Sorry, man. I didn't blow your cover, man. So the notion was that this could work. This could work. My first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had the notion that this could work. And so I took it on. I went to every meeting that was available. You know, I stayed clean. I didn't, you know, partake in the pruno, being brewed under the stairs, or any of that stuff. And, you know, and I went to meetings and I tried to do things. But I had a problem. One, I wasn't very honest. So when I had an opportunity to go through the stamps, the only things I put on my fourth stamp were things that were on my rap sheet. you know, so that I know that if a counselor or somebody pulled my jacket and looked at my four-step, they'd think I was rigorous and thorough, you know, and honest. What bullshit. You know? I was a sociopath. I didn't give a hoot for anything that was on there. I'd stolen cars, robberies, you know, kicking doors in. Nothing meant anything to me. So consequently, I didn't really get it. I didn't really get it at that point. And the other thing was that I had a serious problem from the time that I came in, because somebody told me that this was an allergy, that I had a disease, that this was an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind, which I could relate to. You know, I was screwed up and I couldn't stop. He said, but the only cure for this is spiritual. Well, that ain't gonna work for me. you know, I had 12 years of Catholic school before I went nuts. And, you know, and none of that stuff, you know. That God was a mean, vicious, straight razor toting God that I didn't want anything to do with. And consequently, I didn't have anybody to ask for the help that I needed. But I did know one thing. Two things. I'm Tom, and I cannot take one drink in safety. I knew that. That was boiled into me. So I went to 5 years in that prison, and then I got out, and I went at over four and a half years sober, was sent to 9 months in a drug and rehab alcoholic halfway house, and 5 meetings a day, and, you know, all the stuff, you know, chairing meetings and helping people and all that crap, but I'm still not right, you know. And it was evidenced at home. My wife had come back. She brought my kids back. First time she came to visit me, she said, I don't. And I was like, oh yeah, I knew that was coming. She said, I don't want you to think this is about you. She said, we're here because I don't want your children to think we're the kind of people who would leave their father alone and friendless. Oh, okay, well, whatever. But anyway, so I got home. I had to take a little $6 an hour job, and the IRS caught up with me, and I owed tens and tens of thousands of dollars, and, you know, I was tense about that, and I didn't like my job, and, you know, and my kids wouldn't listen to me, you know, just because I hadn't been around for 6 years. And every time I'd say something to them, I'd say, hey, you, Mom! Made me crazy. Mm-hmm. And I reverted to the way that I acted, the things that worked for me before even I started drinking. Rage and intimidation and putting people in fear and being loud and scary and all that stuff. And I started doing that. You know, punching holes in the doors and screaming and yelling and throwing things. And just one morning, my wife and I were having an argument about a pretty major issue. You know, and that was whether you put, this was before liquid detergent, whether you put the soap or the clothes into the washing machine first. I was of the opinion it didn't matter. They both got all wet and jumbled around and things worked out. She thought it was absolutely imperative that the detergent get in there and get all dissolved and everything before the clothes got in. And it wasn't that I thought I was so right. I just thought it didn't matter. And she did not like the notion that her opinion didn't matter. So about halfway through the end of the argument was that she threw a hot cup of tea in my face and told me to get the hell out and go get drunk. She said, you need to go and drink. You were better off drinking, and we were better off when you were drinking, because you are not fit to live with right now. You are a crazy person, and I don't want you anywhere near these children. Get out. So I left, and I got in my little Nissan in the driveway, and I burned rubber out of the driveway of this little apartment building we were in, and I headed for the nearest bar. Well, the bars downtown in Anchorage, Alaska, open early, but the ones out where I was living didn't. So the bar I went to wasn't open yet. About 9 o'clock in the morning. So I headed into town. Well, to get to town, down the road I went through, you had to pass a place called the Viking Hall. And in the basement of the Viking Hall was kind of an Alano club. They called it the Dry Dock. And I thought, well, I'll give this crap one more try. And so I went in there. Lights are on, doors are open, pot full of coffee, nobody to be found. Sound familiar? Nobody to be found. And I thought, great, this is my ticket. This is God telling me, go get drunk. And I started to head out the hall, and it was down a little hallway where the door was, a little dark hallway from the main room. And in through the door comes this big fisherman, you know, right in off the Bering Sea. And I'd seen him before in meetings. His name is John. And he came in, and, you know, I'm trying to weasel around him in the hallway. And he says, how you doing? Like, I'm an alcoholic. I gave an alcoholic answer. Fine. He says, you're an effing liar. Why don't you tell me how you're really doing? And he was way too big to hit. Seriously, I mean, I came to my senses in an instant there. And I said, okay, fine. My boss is a prick, my wife's a bitch, my kids are little assholes, my dog won't come when I call him, and I don't understand why my program doesn't work. I said, man. He says, I don't understand why your program doesn't work either. Why don't you try ours? It works. I'm like, kid. He says, I'll give it to you real simple, man. He says, I'll give it to you in 6 words. Well, you've all heard them. Trust God, clean house, help others. And I'm like, yeah, I hear that at every meeting. And but then he said something nobody had ever said to me before. He said, what aren't you doing? You know, and there I am. And I openly admitted I didn't have a God in my life I could trust. I did not trust God in any way, shape, or form. So consequently, I didn't have the help and strength I needed to properly clean house, to get rid of the things that were inside of me that were, you know, causing me to explode. And pursuant to that, nobody wanted my help. People were not lining up at the few meetings that I did go to, asking me to be their sponsor. You know? I had one young dude come up to me after a meeting, and he says, how long have you been sober? I said, 5 years. He said, damn, I'm about to get well faster than that. I'm serious. And I just look at him, I'm trying to little asshole. You know? But this guy says, John, he says, we can do this. We can do this right now, you know. He says, I'm willing. He says, I got the weekend off, man. He says, let's do this thing. And I'm like, yeah, you know, my weekend's kind of booked. But maybe Monday. He says, I just told you I had the weekend off. I said, well, he said, look, man. He says, we can really do it right now. All right, you know, so, are you an alcoholic? You know, you think your life's unmanageable by you? Well, in that particular instance, it sure was. They said, okay. He says, do you think that there is or maybe possibly could be a power greater than you that could restore you to sanity? And I said, I hope so, you know. Are you willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand God? I don't understand God. Who can understand God? I said, but I'm willing. He said, great. Come on, buddy. Go in the other room. I think many of you in this room may have been around long enough to remember that you did your fourth step on a big yellow legal tablet with a yellow pencil. And I sat down at the table, and he brought a cup of coffee and a big book. And, you know, he laid that paper down, and he said, all right, man. He says, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do all this other stuff. But before we do, first thing is you're going to tell me that thing you're not going to tell me. He said, you know the one. The one that's too demeaning, too degrading, too debasing, too illegal. Maybe the statute of limitations hasn't run out yet. He said, I don't care, man. He said, you put that right at the top of the page. And I just sat there looking at that page and that pencil, you know, and I knew exactly what it was, but it wasn't coming out. And he said, pick up the pencil. I said, pick up the pencil. I said, well, I will. I'm thinking. He said, you don't need to be thinking. He said, pick up the damn pencil. It is absolutely impossible to do a fourth step without a pencil in your hand. Pick up the pencil. He said, I'll write that thing. And I did. And there it was, out in the open, staring me in the face. And he looked at it, and he said, all right, man. And I thought he was going to call a cop or something. And he just said, all right, man. He says, now I'm going to know you forever. Let's get busy. And so we had a visit with Mr. and Mrs. Brown, and, you know, all the good people in the big book. And, you know, down through it, and then the fears, and then all the stuff, and the sex, and the, it went on for pages and pages. And then he took them all back, and he zipped this fourth column in there. He said, now you're going to put in there what your part in was in every single one of those instances, or with any of those people, or whatever. A good solid 6-hour ordeal with this guy, and I said, okay, here's your 8-step list. He said, who's your first amends? And I realized that through doing all this stuff, none of that crap I talked about before meant anything to me. It's true. What meant something to me was how I had hurt the people in my life who cared about me and loved me and tried to help me, and I disregarded them completely. I went out in the parking lot, and there was a payphone, kind of like a TARDIS, only there's a phone inside. And and I called my mother, Colette, in Philadelphia from Anchorage. She answered the phone. She said, hello. I said, hi, this is Tom. Tom who? It had been 17 years since I'd spoken to my mother or wrote her a letter or even let her know I was alive. And I said, Tommy, your son. Oh, Tommy, where are you? I said, I'm in Alaska, Mom. She said, I wondered where you got off to. What's up? I said, well, Mom, you know, I just wanted to say I know that, you know, I was a rotten little shit and this and that, and we left on bad terms, and I did. She said, oh, Tommy, did you stop drinking? I said, yeah, Mom, this is part of that. She said, I thought so. I got a call from your brother Jimmy about 3 years ago. It sounded just like this. And then she said, come and see me. Click. So I went to my wife and I said, my mother wants me to come and see her. She said, go see her. I'll go. I said, well, you know, I don't, I'm going to do that. You know, I make $6 an hour. She said, well, your boss owns the company. He doesn't make $6 an hour. You go talk to Mark. I went in and said, man, I need to go to the East Coast and see my family. And, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, so this was, you know, about 1991. And he said, how about $1,000? You know, airplane tickets weren't what they are today. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, I'll take two. I said, okay. Pushed this thing there and then called to the bookkeeper and said, put out a check to Tom for $2,000. She said, okay. So I went around, saw her, and got this check. And you know, thought about going to the bank and cashing it and seeing what I could do with it. But, you know, you can always turn it into something more if you're lucky. But I didn't. I didn't. You know, I went home and said, I got money. And my wife said, well, let's go. She took time off from work, and I took time off from work. We flew to Philadelphia. And I thought I was going to just meet up with my mom and, you know, take her to dinner and a nice time. She had the whole family there. Aunts, uncles, cousins, nephews, nieces, my brothers and sisters. There were six of us. All there. And I said, wow, this is a lot. She said, well, I figured if you were coming here to do what Jimmy came here to do, you'd want to see everybody. So I had about 15 face-to-face amends meetings that day. I don't recommend it. But, you know, every single one of them was well-received except my sister. My sister said, you're an a-hole, you'll always be an a-hole. You know, I don't want anything to do with you. Why don't you just have walk back to Alaska or wherever you came from and leave me alone? So she's the one I called my sponsor about. He said, you know, Tommy, it's not about her. It's not about her. She's entitled to her feelings. She's entitled to her opinions. And you, sir, have done what you could do, so you should start feeling good about yourself. So, stuck around a couple of days, went back to Alaska, and started doing the deal. Started going to meetings in earnest. Found a couple of people who would accept my help, you know, and life got better. And it continues to get better. It's I still have a home group. I still attend meetings regularly. I still do this every once in a while. You know, I just try to keep in the knowledge that I am an alcoholic and I cannot take one drink in safety. Thanks for letting me share, guys.
Thank you.
Awesome, dude. Thank you. Good round of applause. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers donations to the church and supplies. The rest is given to Tidewater Inner Group, District 24, and the General Service Office. Are there any AA-related announcements?
program right now.
So Mitch.
Saturday the 26th at Prince George State Group in Prince George. Blaine and I will be picking up 2-year medallions, and Jim G. from Farmville, Virginia will be sharing his story at that celebration. Also, I should have announced this last week when I was here, the Roanoke Men's Workshop is going on the first weekend in May. There are still open spots available. If anybody needs any information or the registration form, please see me after the meeting and I can get it to you.
Tom, alcoholic.
Tom.
Liberty Bell Group celebrates our 29th birthday party and coupled with an AA pamphlet workshop. Sunday, July 6, 2025, from 11 to 4 in Pavilion 2 at White Bank Park in Colonial Heights, Virginia. Hot dogs, hamburgers, and drinks provided. Please bring a side dish. We will have an Ask a Basket meeting at 1 p.m. and an award for the best red, white, and blue outfit, and the AA pamphlet workshop from 2 to 4 p.m., a fun journey through a variety of AA pamphlets. Bring your own favorites. Family and friends, welcome, and I'll leave this here for you folks.
Thank you.
Thank you. July 6th, thank you.
Jake, non-alcoholic. Okay. I didn't hear anybody announce our anniversary, which is happening next Friday. April 25th, dinner from 7 to 7:45, workshop from 7:45 to 9. We're doing an Ask a Basket afterwards. It's going to be in this room, and we're going to have a panel of 3 panelists: Roger W, Adita A, Joyce K. They're going to be talking about their experience about with the effect of sponsorship, and there will be plenty of food. Bring a dish if you wish. But please come for that. Also, District 24 annual picnic is scheduled for September 20th. That's going to be at Portsmouth City Park, Shelter 3. We're working on getting flyers developed. And if anybody is interested in getting on the committee for that or being a part of it during the day of, let me know. We'll get you involved. Thanks.
Thank you, Trey.
I'd add that last year's district picnic, there was a record amount of money that was raised for Pie in the Ox. And in case anybody, who was there that saw it last year? It was incredible. Somehow my granddaughter got picked to give him Pie in the Eye, and we thought she broke
somehow.
She hit him so hard with the bam.
I will not be doing it this year. But actually, last year's went well. We're going to be selling tickets for those as well. And it's basically, what do we call that?
50-50 raffle?
50-50 raffle. Thank you. Thank you. So we're going to be walking around over the next few months selling those. $2 a ticket. You don't have to be there to win it. So you write down your name.